Thank you. I'm going to talk to you about some of our recent work here in David Aschlon's lab. Before I get started, let me just acknowledge, you know, good people like our funding agents and the folks that are working in the group. David Toiley is over here. Joe Harriman's also worked on these projects, as well as some outstanding external collaborations. And I want to particularly point out some of the work is done with samples that were prepared by Thomas Schenkel and his students at Lawrence Berkeley National Labs. And I'm not going to probably have time to talk about that work. It's a way of creating NV centers with ion implantation, but so if there's time later, we can discuss that. But at any rate, that those guys are there, and they are much appreciated. So here is what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to diamond NV centers. Those of you that attended Professor Lucan's talk last week, some of this is review. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about spin resonance. And for those of you sort of experts in the audience, please bear with me. But this is sort of the crux of what's going on in this talk. And so I'm going to really try to make sure I'm really clear about those issues. And then I'll talk about two experiments. In the first experiment, we do spectroscopy. In all these cases, we're working at room temperature and we're using single NV centers. So in this first experiment, we're going to do spectroscopy of the spin levels of the excited state of the NV center. And hopefully I'll share with you why that's an interesting thing to do. And then in the second experiment, I'll tell you a little bit about a case where we drive the spin in its ground state very, very hard and look at what sort of interesting dynamics emerge from that situation. Okay, so let's just start out with basic motivation. Why NV centers? So if we could think of sort of a wish list. You have your Christmas wish list. Mine's on Amazon. You can check it out if you want. But at any rate, if we had a wish list for a quantum system to work on as either quantum scientists or quantum engineers, it would have a number of properties. And there's a much more formal list of requirements, but this isn't that. This is a wish list. Of course, things that we would want include sort of coherent control over the states. We would want to be able to manipulate the states. And we would want there to be long coherence times to be able to do interesting things in the time that we have. Now, of course, we would certainly like it to operate under ambient conditions. And by that, I mean at room temperature and sort of in air, so no large pump. Solid state is a nice property of a system simply because we can just borrow a huge number of tools from the semiconductor industry, fabrication and all these sorts of other things that people have developed over the past several decades, and we can just steal some of those techniques. Coupling to light is very important because, of course, if you ever want to communicate any of your quantum information, you would need to encode it into photons. That's the sort of best flying qubit that people are aware of. I guess the briefcase is, yeah, that was mentioned earlier. But coupling to light is important. And then finally, the last thing, you would want some engineerable system so that you can scale it up, both from the perspective of doing engineering and also from the perspective of just building more and more complicated and interesting experiments. Okay, so now let's compare these wish list items with NV spins and diamond. Okay, so first of all, they have fantastically long coherence, as you've heard previously from Professor Lucan's talk. So people have already seen millisecond duration T2 times in isotopically engineered material. And they're very convenient. So as I'll show you later, you can optically initialize and read out. So you really, it's really a nice system from that perspective. It is an ambient condition experiment, so all the work that I'm going to show you happened at room temperature and in air. It is a solid state system. It has an optical transition in the visible, so there are schemes for coupling with photons. And then finally, this one. And I have to say that until like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, this was a problem. And the reason is that people would sort of do these experiments with diamond NV centers by going and getting some natural diamond, and they would put it in their microscope, and they would make beautiful measurements. But at the end of the day, they still have to find that one NV center that has nice properties. What you really want is to make the NV center, put it where you want it to go, so that you can think about scaling up the system. Fortunately, that situation has changed quite a bit. So recently, first of all, you can get really high quality synthetic diamond. So you're not relying on finding some special diamond mine somewhere. So that's good. And then the other thing that you can do is you can adopt some of the ion implanting technologies that were developed, again, for the semiconductor industry and try to use some of those things to sort of engineer the system. So there's definitely a direction that you can go there. All right, so now let's talk a little bit about the defect center itself. So this is what an NV center looks like. So these are carbon atoms in the diamond lattice. This is a nitrogen, substitutional nitrogen atom. And then here's a vacancy. That's a spot where there's a missing carbon. And you can think about this thing like having a little molecular state. So there's a wave function of electrons trapped here in this lattice. And it is a spin triplet, and its ground state Hamiltonian looks like this. And in fact, this is just a very straightforward and Hamiltonian for essentially any molecular spin system. So in particular, there's three terms here that we're going to worry about for the ground state. So there is a crystal field splitting, and it's along the symmetry axis given by this green bond. It's around 2.87 gigahertz, which is a very convenient splitting for us to work with. It's just, you know, sort of the same as your cell phone, more or less. Zeeman energy, that's just the way that the spin levels shift as a function of magnetic field. And it has the regular G factor of a free electron, so they shift by 2.8 megahertz per Gauss. And a hyperfine interaction, that is the interaction between the nuclear spin of this nitrogen and this sort of electronic wave function here. And that's not a very strong effect in the ground state, it's a few megahertz, but it is going to be important for some things, so we'll include it here. Now we put those together and we make a plot of the spin levels as a function of magnetic field, and we get levels that look like this. And one of the things that you really notice here is that this is a highly tunable system. Just by changing the position of a permanent magnet or current through a coil, you can shift these spin levels by quite a lot to look at a number of different regimes, and that's one of the things that we're going to do here. So that's one of the nice aspects, is this is just a really highly tunable system. Okay. Now the optical properties are also quite important, so let me mention those. This whole thing is sitting in the band gap of diamond, and so you have an excited state level that's 1.945 eV above the ground state electronic level, and it is also a spin triplet, which makes this essentially a cycling transition, with the exception of sort of one important thing, and that is the presence of this singlet state here. There is a spin-selective crossing to this singlet state, and that crossing allows us to have both optical pumping into the ground state, and that's because it's sort of selective from the plus and minus one states, goes through a spin singlet, and then relaxes into zero. So if we're not sure what the spin state is, we just shine light on it. Eventually, it's going to end up initialized into the M sub s equals zero. So that's nice. Additionally, this gives us an optical readout. Because you see, this is a non-radiative transition. So we only collect these visible photons if it starts out in zero and then relaxes down. So that gives you a little contrast. So there's a sort of rate of crossing here that doesn't exist here. And so it's about a 35% contrast or so. So if you want to know the spin state, you just shine some light in, measure the photons that come out. You're going to get more photons coming out statistically when it's in the M sub s equals plus 1 or minus 1 than when it's in the zero state. So that gives us a way of measuring what the spin actually is. Okay, and then a quick word about the experimental apparatus. This is a rather prosaic confocal microscopy arrangement. So we have a green laser that we use to excite, a steering mirror to move the direction of the beam where it focuses on the sample. So here's the sample, a microscope objective. We can focus down into a roughly 350 nanometer sort of diffraction, almost diffraction limited spot. We have a permanent magnet here to apply a magnetic field. We just move it around to change the angle and intensity of that field. And then we collect the luminescence into avalanche photodiode detectors. And one of the things that we can do when we scan around on the surface, then we see these little bright spots. Those are the NV centers. And we can check that they're single NV centers by the fact that if they are, they're single quantum emitters. That means they can only give up one photon at a time. So by passing the photoluminescence through this 50-50 beam splitter and looking at the correlations here, we can see that it's a single photon emitter because you can't emit two photons at once. So it sort of simultaneity for these two, zero delay between these two detectors. There's no correlations between the counts, or rather there's high correlations. The correlation count goes to zero. Okay.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
State? I mean, how well actually is it the dark state? So that means it's totally dark. I mean, there's no transition possible.
From the singlet state?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is sort of a shelving state. What happens is there's this inter-system crossing that takes place from here, and it just sort of sits here for around 300 nanoseconds, and then it relaxes. It actually I'm smoothing over some of the details. There's actually people have seen some IR light coming out of there, and then it finally relaxes into the zero state.
Like the amount of state.
Yeah. But.
So what is the fidelity for which you can visualize?
Okay, so that's a great question, and the answer is it's not 100%. So there is some, you know, polarization. People have done some studies by comparing essentially EPR measurements and sort of measurements of this sort where you're looking at one spin. And what they find is that you still have some population in the other levels. And so you have to sort of renormalize your states. And it's of order 70% is what I understand.
It can be higher.
Is that right?
It also depends a little bit against X-ray and so on.
Right.
Actually, I think Waddle has it's recently done spin tomography of this, special fidelity, and it's very high. So,
in some experiments, you also like 98 or something.
Okay, so it depends on the NV center, yeah. So, anyway. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about spin resonance, because that's the major tool that we're going to use in all the preceding experiments. So spin resonance, this is really sort of straightforward stuff. You have two spin levels, and we're just going to think about two-level dynamics. So let's just pick two. We'll use the -1 spin level and the 0 spin level. And remember now, we're going to read this out just because the 0-1 is a brighter state than the -1 level. So that's going to tell us what we're measuring. But if we apply a microwave photon and it has energy that's the same as this splitting, then we can write down another term in the Hamiltonian that looks like this gamma e to the I omega t, which is just the Hamiltonian for this photon, and it causes transitions between these two levels. And so this is a classic problem in physics. It's solved by Rabi, and so you just get Rabi oscillations between these two levels. Now, I do want to point out something very carefully, because I'm going to come back to this later. The way I've written this, this is a circularly polarized photon. That's actually not what we apply in the experiment. We apply linearly polarized photons with our microwave setup. And so most of the time, this isn't important, and later it is. And I just want to warn you of that for now. But for right now, let's not worry about that. So this is what it would look like. This is a sort of lab domain simulation of these dynamics. It's still processing. That's what spins do. They process. But as we also apply these microwaves, then it's going up and down between the two spin levels. So I guess formally we could call this nutation. Okay. And when we measure this in the laboratory by applying pulses of increasing duration and looking at what the final state is, we get data that looks like this. So it just oscillates between bright and dark, bright and dark, bright and dark. And those are Rabi oscillations. Okay, so that's a sort of time domain measurement. Yes?
You have a schematic of the microwave source and the way it's being applied to the chip. Schematic, semi-faithful, what you're actually doing? Is it just sort of a centrifugal finger wave guide or strip line wave guide?
Okay, so there's actually the detailed answer to that question is different data in this experiment is done in different ways. So this little picture, this is the picture that's very similar to what we used for the sort of spectroscopic measurements that I'll tell you about in a little while. And it's literally just a piece of coaxial transmission line, and then it's shorted with a wire. And so you just stick the wire on your diamond, and the easiest thing ever. Yeah. Later on, I'll show you when we get to the strong driving work, if we want to do this much better, we have to do some lithography, and I'll show you what that looks like, and I'll be more specific about that.
But
these data are taken with the newer setup, actually. Yeah. We were able to get something of order 15 megahertz, roughly. And then if you want to do better than that, you need to work harder. And it depends on the frequency and some things, but yeah. Okay, now the other thing that you can do is spectroscopy. So here what we're doing is instead of varying the sort of duration of the burst, instead we're going to just change this value omega. So we're just gonna scan it across these transitions, and then what we see is as it comes into resonance, we see a dip in the photoluminescence, and so that tells us that there's a level there. So we can sort of think about those as the two main schemes that we're going to use. We're going to either do time domain measurements, or we're going to do frequency domain measurements, in other words, spectroscopy. Okay, So that's going to be the first experiment I'm going to tell you about, is where we use these spectroscopic techniques to examine the spin levels up in this excited state. So people have really understood this ground state Hamiltonian for a very long time. And what we're interested in here is looking at the excited state Hamiltonian. Now, this isn't totally an easy thing to do from the sense that you excite up into this level and it doesn't stay there for very long. It takes about 10 nanoseconds and it comes back down again. So you kind of have to be quick about what you're doing. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We're just going to sort of use the same setup that we're using. We're going to do a very careful job of calibrating our microwave setup so that we apply microwaves that are spectrally flat across a very broad area, okay, so that we apply the same intensity at all frequencies, and then sweep the frequency and look at where the transitions occur. And what we see is these very sharp features are the ground state spin transitions that have been known about for a long time. But when we keep turning up the power, we eventually see the emergence of these additional very broad features that we can tentatively assign to the excited states. So let's think about the sort of Hamiltonian arguments here. Here's the ground state spin Hamiltonian that we know about very well. There's also got to be some Hamiltonian of the excited state. It's been known for a long time it was a spin triplet. But of course, the terms might be different, so we should expect some different splittings. Okay, the other thing is we should expect it to be very broad because they're not long-lived states. Okay, so here what we're doing is we're simultaneously optically pumping the NV center while we apply our microwaves. And if the microwaves are strong enough, we're going to cause rotations that we can detect, and that's what we're seeing. Okay, so one thing that we can do now is we can actually turn that around and make sure that we optically pump it at one time and apply the microwaves while the laser is off. That's a way to ensure that we can't see the excited state. And if we do that, we should see these features go away. And that's exactly what we do see. So here's the excited state features. And you see that when we apply this duty cycle where we turn the laser on, and then we turn it off again and apply the microwaves, and then read out, you see that these excited states features vanish, confirming they're indeed related to the excited state. Okay. And then we can just check some experimental parameters to see that it's making sense. So for example, as you might expect, the amplitude here of these excited state resonances get bigger as we apply a larger microwave field, okay? But their width is essentially independent of the microwave field, and that's expected because they're not saturated. We can't cause a full pi rotation with this level of microwave field in the 10 nanoseconds or so that we're up there. So those are some very basic things, but they really tell us, yes, this is what we're seeing. Okay, now let's take lots of data. Here's what you get. So here is the sort of same basic kind of data that I showed you before, taken as a function of frequency and magnetic field. The z-axis is the photoluminescence intensity. Now remember that you get dips on resonance. Those are sort of hard to follow in this format, so I've just flipped the data over. So these peaks are now the dips. And what you can see here, these are the sharp features or the ground state resonances. These broad features are the excited state resonances. And you can essentially read the Hamiltonian right off of this data. So you can see that the excited state has a different value of zero field splitting. It's roughly half the value as in the ground state. But they have a G factor that's the same. These are parallel lines to one another. So it still has a G factor of 2. And then you see right here, at around 500 Gauss, you have this broad feature, and that's where the minus 1 excited state level crosses over 0. So there's sort of a level crossing there. And this is actually observed by Ryan Epstein several years ago, just doing sort of photoluminescence versus magnetic field. Without any microwaves, he saw a big dip right at 500 Gauss. And now we can see what's happening. There's a 0 frequency crossing right there, causing a mixing of the spin levels. Okay, if we look at these, yeah.
Just so clear, this is a single center.
Yes.
And as you go from center to center, how does this change the quality?
I am going to show you that. So please, thank you for asking the question, and I will bring that up later. Okay, if we look at these broad things in more detail, you see that these are actually not a single transition, but actually they're a doublet. The fact that they're very wide makes that very hard to see, but there's a splitting here of around 60 megahertz. And so, you know, we sort of scratched our heads on that for a little while and realized this is actually the hyperfine interaction. This is the splitting induced by the nitrogen nucleus. Now, I told you previously that that was a small effect. It was like 3 megahertz. In the excited state, the situation is quite a bit different. Now, people have done sort of ab initio calculations of these centers, looking at the spin density from both the perspective of the ground state and the excited state. And what you see is that in the ground state, there's very little spin density in the position of that nitrogen nucleus. And that leads to that small splitting. But in the excited state, there's a much bigger spin density leading to this much larger splitting. And in fact, those of you sort of chemistry people out there can appreciate this from a different way. In the ground state, this nitrogen is more electronegative. Well, it's always more electronegative. But in the ground state, it has a pair of electrons here, hence very little spin density. The excited state promotes one of those electrons. And so that means there is an unpaired spin in the vicinity of this nitrogen. And that gives you a high spin density, leading to a strong hyperfine contact hyperfine term, giving you this big splitting. Now, the other thing you notice is when you look at these two peaks at different values of the magnetic field, you see there's also a polarization that goes on. So you see that these are roughly the same amplitude at high and low field. But near that anti-crossing, you have a strong polarization of the nitrogen nuclear spin. So what's actually going on is dynamic nuclear polarization. The polarization of the electronic spin is getting transferred to the nuclear spin as it is in the excited state. It sort of stays up there, processes a little while, and then relaxes, transferring that polarization. You could think of this as a way to initialize kind of a two-qubit system. And people have actually already showed some neat things you can do with this trick.
I have a question. I mean, you said it's a contact hyperfine interaction. It's more a dipolar because you're going, you know, away actually from the overlap.
Well, there may be two terms there, but so I agree with what you're saying. But I think the basic story is there's spin overlap. So there's two electrons that live right here in the ground state. So they're spin cancel. I mean, they're net spin locally.
So it's the valence shell of nitrogen is in S. Is
it S? Yeah.
I
should be very careful what I say because I haven't done these calculations, but yeah, from a simple argument.
Can you tell whether it's isotropic, the hyperfine interaction, or anisotropic?
That's a good question. I haven't done a detailed angular dependence of it. I haven't seen it vary from, actually, in this paper, there's some discussion of that. But I don't think there's any experimental evidence out there one way or the other. Yeah, it could be done. It just, we haven't done it.
There is a sort of heuristic you can apply based on the picture, actually. You see, and you'll notice that the spin density, its moments look almost the same. So you can expect the dipolar contribution to be almost the same from the left and right. And it's just this small contact change, of course, makes a big change.
I think it depends a little bit, you know, what the other electron is doing. They could still be the same size.
But these are the spin density circles.
Yeah, this is the spin density.
Well,
and
so it shows you where the unpaired
spins are. Yeah, it shows you where the unpaired spins are, yeah. Well,
that, I mean, that's actually, that's going to be the term. I guess it's going to be both there.
Yeah.
Are we all happy?
Probably
an excited state, which
is one way to
get
Yeah, that's always been our problem. Yeah, that's right. We could do this experiment. We just haven't done it. Okay. So if you take all this data that I showed you previously and you just find the position of all of these peaks, you can fit it to the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. And this is essentially the same Hamiltonian I showed you for the ground state. There is one other term that is more or less zero on the ground state, so I omitted it. And that is this transverse anisotropy term. It comes from strain spin-spin coupling, and it actually is what is responsible for opening this little gap here at low magnetic field. And you can see that just by fitting these, we can get all of these terms. So this gap isn't insignificant. It's around 70 megahertz is the coefficient of this term. And now getting back to the previous question, what happens when you look at another NV center? So we did that, and if you look at another NV center that's just a couple of microns away, what happens is you can have a different value of the local strain. And so that's the thing that couples into that E term in the Hamiltonian, the transverse anisotropy splitting, and that can lead to a big difference in where those spin levels are at low magnetic field. And so we see that. At low magnetic field, we see a big variability in sort of the intercept. Now, these have the same zero field splitting. So if you take the average of the frequencies, that's the same. But if you just look at the positions here, you see quite a bit of variation between different centers. Okay, so that actually is kind of nice because you actually have some knobs there that you can turn. Strain is something that isn't totally unknown how to engineer. So that's something that's good. Let me also make one other comment here. Since we've worked on this project, there's been a lot of people interested in excited about the excited state. Ooh, that was... Anyway, at any rate, it turns out, as Professor Lucan also mentioned in his talk, the excited state is a very complicated object. So you have these two different sort of branches. So these are actually each spin triplets, and it depends a lot on strain. And in fact, the case that we're actually considering here, for those of you experts, we're actually looking at emotionally narrowed resonance in this particular case. And this is still sort of evolving experimentally. So there's a lot of recent work that's been published. Okay, let's move on to the next experiment before we totally run out of time. So this is a little bit different kind of a measurement. Now we're going to go back to looking at our time domain dynamics. And what we're going to do is try driving the spin very hard and see if we can see something that happens that's interesting. Now there's a couple of reasons why we would want to do this. First of all, from a fundamental physics perspective, we're just going to try to look at it sort of how does the two-level dynamics evolve as we drive the spin harder and harder, and what kind of new behavior are we going to be able to observe? And additionally, sort of from a quantum information perspective, I think most of you appreciate that you need to really go fast as you can, because decoherence is sort of your enemy. You're trying to battle decoherence. And sort of the figure of merit is the ratio between the coherence time and the time for an operation. So here we're only considering single qubit operations, but still we would like to see sort of what we can do with that and sort of how fast you can manipulate it, when do things become a problem, what are problems, what can you actually live with? And the first step is to just look at dynamics pushing it as fast as we can. But ultimately, the hope is many, many operations can lead to error correction and also fast dynamical decoupling. And of course, one of the comments I would make is that NV spins are really a good model system because the Hamiltonian is very tunable. You can sort of set that splitting up to be anything that you want it to be. And we're going to take advantage of that. Okay, so let me start by just telling you about the usual case. And I'm coming back to that comment that I made earlier on, that experimentally, we always apply oscillating magnetic fields. In other words, photons that are linearly polarized. But the reality is that sort of Rabi's equation is an exact solution for circularly polarized photons, or rotating waves, as people talk about in this field. And so you can think about the relationship between those. So in green here is this oscillating field that we apply, but you can write that as the sum of two counter-rotating fields. And so really only one of those rotating fields are the ones that we normally use for spin resonance. That's because as the spin sort of does its natural thing, which is precess about the total effective field, one of those is going to precess with the spin. So it's always going to exert a torque on it in the same relative direction, and that's going to cause the coherent rotations. The other one sort of is coming in and out and applying torques in different directions. It still applies torque, but it just averages out, typically. And that's the sort of basis of the rotating wave approximation. So as you can see here, we can just write yellow and blue are green. What we're going to do is consider the case where both of these rotating fields are going to play an important role. Now, the rotating wave approximation is going to start to break down when the sort of rate of this precession, which is determined by the Larmor field H0, is going to start to become comparable to the strength of these rotating fields. And when that happens, we're going to see sort of some new things emerge. So here's how we're doing this, and let me get back to this question. We had to be a little bit better microwave engineers here. So this fits onto our sort of connector. So this is a standard SMA connector. This is a commercial coplanar waveguide. And then you see that this is our diamond. It's about a 3-millimeter sample for scale. And these little guys, we actually have, you know, a couple of patterns stepped out on it. Let me zoom in on one of those patterns. So what we've done is just taken our little waveguide and then just shorted it. So right in there, we're going to get a very large current density locally. And that current density is going to give us a large microwave field. So if we take an NV center that's very close to the edge of that waveguide, we're going to be able to apply very large microwave fields. And we can do this in a way that allows the power to be relatively low in comparison to other sort of previous methods and very spectrally flat, meaning when we change the frequency, the total power is essentially the same. Okay. So here's a sort of schematic of what it would look like locally. There's some wire here. There's some current going through the wire. Of course, we still have a static magnetic field applied, and then we have a microwave field that's being oscillating like this, sort of in the plane. One thing I should also note is the orientation of the diamond. So the diamond is 001 oriented. The NV center is 11 oriented. So we're essentially throwing away one of sort of part of the microwave field, because we're only going to be really using the projection perpendicular to the spin to manipulate it. So one of the things that you can do is just go much faster. So if you just tune the Hamiltonian into the standard regime where you have a big H0 and just standard spin resonance, so this is an example of 300 megahertz Rabi oscillations that you can do using this technique. But that's not what we're going to do for the experiment. What we're going to do is we're going to tune the Hamiltonian to where H0 is relatively small, so 0.49 gigahertz, so roughly half a gigahertz. And then at that value of magnetic field, the other spin level is way up here, split off by about 5 gigahertz. So we're really going to be looking at two-level dynamics and not have sort of any interference from that other level. So again, I'm always going to sort of give fields in frequency units. So H0, which is literally just the rate of Larmor precession, is going to be what I'm going to call the field that's causing the precession of the spin. Okay, now let me also remind you once more of the measurement, because there's a subtle and important detail here. The way that we measure this is we use a sampling scheme, meaning we prepare the spin, we apply a pulse of finite duration, which we vary, and then we read out the state. So each point is a separate experiment, and each point only represents the final state of the spin. And I can't stress that enough. That's really important, because when we compare to theory, that's going to be something that we're going to look at. Now, of course, one of the other things I want to point out is that when you look at this data, okay, you say, all right, well, here's 0, here's -1. Well, how do we know that? We really should be a little more careful. So what we really need to do is also find a way of sort of independently determining what are the eigenstates, so we sort of know the visibility of our oscillations, right? So that's sort of important to do. So what we're going to, yeah. It's roughly 10 to the 5 per point. So this takes about an hour to measure, roughly, in lab time, because the duty cycle isn't very long. It's like a few microseconds. So you just run.
The initialization has this fidelity you mentioned at the beginning.
And it's just determined by things like the strain. So it is what it is. It does vary from center to center. In the end of the day, I think you can make a pretty simple argument that you sort of renormalize. You have some thing that you just can forget about. I'm not so worried about that. Okay. So the way that we're going to measure what our eigenstates actually are is use a technique that we're going to borrow from the NMR community, which is called adiabatic passage. And for you specialists out there, what we're doing is a Landau-Zener transition in the rotating frame. But for the rest of us, what we're going to do is essentially apply microwaves. They're going to be strongly detuned from the resonance. And then we're going to sweep the frequency of the microwaves through the resonance. And what's going to happen is the spin is just going to follow that frequency. Okay, it's just going to flip over. And the probability of staying in the initial state is given by this Landau-Zener formula, which is exponential in these variables, which means that we can make an exponentially good spin flip, which is what we want to do. So experimentally, we just apply, say, above or below the transition, sweep through it, and then what happens is it just ends up in the other state. And that we can do then, independent of the Rabi driving, to know what the visibility of our Rabi oscillations actually are. And then here's the simulation that shows you what's going on. So it just kind of goes from up to down. Okay, So in the laboratory, we can check to make sure that that's actually what's happening. So the first thing is we identify the adiabatic regime. So in this measurement, we're fixing the intensity of the driving field. We're fixing the range of sweeping. So I'm going to go a total range of 300 megahertz from 150 above the resonance to 150 below, but I'm going to change the amount of time I take to get through. So what I'm doing is I'm varying f dot, the sweep rate. And so what I see is I start, of course, with no duration time, I'm not flipping the spin at all. And as I sweep slower and slower and slower, the transition rate saturates to a very good spin flips. Now you also see on top of this these oscillations, and those are expected, yes?
This is human initializations.
Yes.
So if you have your perfect initialization.
But this just flips the states. So let's say that I have, I guess I can get out the chalkboard, but let's say that I have some population in non-zero states, right? It just swaps them. So what that does is, so if you think of, we could factorize the Hamiltonian essentially, and there's another term that's going to be constant. It's not going to affect anything, is the basic story. I think that's the right way to think about it. That's correct. That's exactly what it is. Okay. Okay, so at any rate, what we see when we do the measurement is extremely good agreement. So this is just a fit to a simple exponential, and it agrees within 1% of the values that we independently measure for H1 and F dot. So this is actually working really well. Yeah?
Just a question about initialization. Is this fraction that aren't correctly initialized, these are zero as opposed to one, or are these sort of leakage errors where you're in a different state?
Okay, I think the way to think about it is you essentially, maybe thinking about it in terms of thermal population would make more sense. So let's say that we don't shine any light in the NV center and wait a long time. We're going to have a thermal population of the spin levels, which is essentially the same for everything because, right, it's room temperature. So the spin levels is micro EV and we have, right, okay. So if we wait for long enough, that's what we're going to have. Then we shine in light and initialize. Well, actually, there's three, so yeah. So then we shine in light. And when we do that, we're optically pumping. We're sort of cooling the spin temperature down, and we get more and more population in zero. There could be some residual population in minus one and plus one. But we can also, so that's basically what we're talking about. The question then goes to how much is there? And I think the answer, I think, was best put by Professor Lucan. It's just some small amount, maybe 5%, something like that. We could always just write a factorized Hamiltonian, though, that just has that as a separate thing and just work with the polarization that we have, just like they do in NMR. I don't think that... Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. All right. So this allows us to really tell what does it take to get a good spin flip. So now what we're going to do for the experiment, we want to have a really good spin flip. So we're going to go way out here. So this is sweeping for 200 nanoseconds. This data, I actually do the spin flip, watch its evolution, but here we're using a 600 nanosecond sweep time. So what you see here is an extremely good spin flip that's prepared. And it looks exactly like the simulation. It literally just goes through this transition, right where it goes through the resonance at 0.49 gigahertz. Okay, so we first varied F dot, then we varied the whole thing and just looked at this in continuous evolution. All right, that's now, for the rest of the time, how I'm going to determine what is spin up and spin down. So I'm going to have red dashed lines on all the plots. Those are determined by initialization and adiabatic passage. So that's what you're looking at, okay? All right, now here is a plot of the Rabi frequency that we measure as a function of power that we put into the device. And what we're going to do is go through continuously the range where we're in the sort of good rotating wave approximation regime to where we're totally violating it. So we're going to start where H1, the driving field, is 15 times smaller than the Larmor precession rate, okay, to the point where they're essentially equal. And we're going to look at the evolution that takes place. I mean the splitting between the two levels. Yeah, it's actually, so H0 here is the zero field splitting plus the applied field. Yeah, it's the static splitting. That's right. Okay. So in the beginning, what we see is just nice Rabi oscillations, just like we should expect. Then we drive it a little harder, And we still see nice Rabi oscillations, although you see little, perhaps small deviations. And then it really starts to kind of, now we're sort of halfway through, we're starting to getting to the point where it becomes important. And one thing I want you to note now is the scale is also changing. So this is 100 nanoseconds, this is 40. As we drive it harder and harder, we need to use smaller and smaller steps to see the detail. And the detail is showing us that we have these sort of places where it gets stuck, and then it jumps, and then it gets stuck, and then it jumps. And then it just sort of goes almost nuts. So you see, again, stuck, jumps, stuck, jumps. And this is the strongest driving that we see. So this behavior is even more sort of amplified here. We see very rapid changes in the spin projection, and then we see places where it gets really sort of stuck for a long while. Okay. So let's try to understand what is going on with this behavior. So what you see here is a simulation. It includes all the levels, but one of the things is that the third level is so far away, nothing's going on with it. And what we've actually done is measured the exact microwave pulse. So this is a microwave pulse with nominally 10 nanosecond duration. And the simulated spin dynamics, how the spin evolves continuously through the pulse. And what you see is that the behavior is qualitatively very similar to what we measure in the experiment. However, one thing to note, here we have a real pulse tail. This is a real artifact of having a real laboratory. Okay, there's an actual rise time here. So there are some imperfections. And if you want to make a really good comparison to your data, you need to include those things. So that's what we did. So we measured every single pulse in the experiment. We simulated the final population all the way to the end, and then compared that to the data. So that's what's in this column. Here is what we see in the experiment. And what you see is, again, in the beginning, there's very good agreement. And then by the time, we still have qualitative agreement, but there are greater and greater differences the stronger and stronger we drive it. That's perhaps not very surprising. Remember, there are no free parameters in this simulation. We literally just write down the Hamiltonian and the driving field and evolve the states. So one of the things that we find, and in agreement with previous theory, is that it's very, very sensitive to the pulse shape. But it should also be noted, remember, each point here is the average of 10 to the 5 measurements. So these dynamics are incredibly reproducible. You can go into the lab on a different day and get exactly the same thing. They're just sensitive to exactly what the conditions are. Now, one of the things that we noticed in the simulation that we didn't actually see in the experimental data is that the simulation suggests that we should have a very fast, nearly complete spin flip immediately. And that's something from an application perspective that you would want. So this is a pulse that has a nominal sort of half Larmor period duration, right? So that's sort of the kind of thing that you would like to see from the perspective of very fast manipulation of the states. But we don't see that in the experiment. And so we sort of wondered if we could twiddle and get it to happen. So one of the things that we tried is we borrowed another technique from NMR, and that is pulse shaping. So we're using Gaussian pulses in this case. And the idea here is a little bit different than what they want to do in NMR. There, they're trying to narrow the bandwidth of the driving. What we're trying to do is trying to suppress the sort of transience of the leading and trailing edge, which we thought might be having a deleterious effect on the spin rotation. So here's what the pulses look like. So this is a nominally 10 nanosecond Gaussian pulse. And here's the simulated dynamics. And you can see in the middle of the pulse, the dynamics look very similar to the simulations with square pulses. But there's more gradual rotation at the leading and trailing edges. So when we do this experiment, here is the data that I showed you before. These are starting at a higher driving field. So we're already at 100 megahertz. Here's the Gaussian data. And what you can see is the Gaussian pulses really sort of, for lower driving, recover some of the nicer behavior instead of this square behavior, square pulse behavior, giving square behavior. But as we drive it harder and harder, even the Gaussian pulses give you sort of this anharmonic spin rotation for short times. Now, one of the things that we were very excited about, however, is that when you look at the Gaussian data for strong driving, you actually get these spin rotations that we were looking for. These very fast spin flips from sub-Larmor precession pulses. And so if you actually look at the simulation, that's, again, what you should expect. And if you look at the simulated dynamics, so if you take this point here, essentially a 1 nanosecond Gaussian pulse, this is what the microwave pulse actually looks like. It doesn't take a nanosecond, okay? I want to be clear about that. But these little ring down here and this little leading edge, that's sort of deleterious effects of the real experimental parts. This ringing actually comes from the amplifier, and it's unrelated to the Rabi frequency, or excuse me, the Larmor frequency. The only part that has really sort of got the right curvature is this part right here. So what happens is the spin sort of doesn't do anything, and then it sees this curvature and it goes pop down, and then this stuff doesn't really do anything. In fact, if you do the simulations and you just cut off that, so clearly more engineering here would be important. But what we see is a very fast spin rotation. Yeah.
Looks like your experimental time is shorter than what you're showing in your simulation.
The experimental time is shorter.
Yes,
that's correct. These are not the same. Yes, it's faster.
So you're not able to produce the simulation that gives you the same.
We are not able to perfectly reproduce the simulation, and I can tell you what I think is the reason. I think the reason is that we can't measure at the position of the NV center, right? So at the end of the day, we have a one-terminal device, a one-port microwave device, right? We have a cable we connect our thing to. Now, when we measure these pulses, we have to measure somewhere. We don't have a detector except for the spin itself right at the position where the spin is. So we hook it up to our oscilloscope and we measure it. There's going to be very small distortions as it goes into the device, but the sensitivity in this regime is very, very high, so that gives you a difference in the results.
Do you expect that the actual amplitude is larger than what you do, or what is different about the experimental pulse?
Well, I mean, so one of the things is that you have extreme sensitivity to the relative phase of the spin and the oscillation, which is something that you normally don't have. Sort of the area rule is violated in this regime. And so what that means is that you can have small shifts in the phase as you go into the device, which we don't detect in the oscilloscope.
Add those shifts to your simulation.
Well, we don't know what they are.
Go one way or go the other.
Okay.
Like it's a lot easier to do the simulation.
I mean, it is a lot easier to do the simulations. But there's nothing to do with the simulations. We measure the pulse, we simulate. We don't have anything to fit. We don't have any parameters. So we just, that's what it is. I mean, clearly, a person.
Add more parameters to make the data fit.
Yeah, of course.
But that's largely meaningless.
Yeah, I just didn't feel like that was an appropriate thing to do.
We could
Yeah, that's true. That is true. We could be better microwave engineers, and we're working in that direction. But this is just simply what it is.
But if you look at the super complicated regime down at the bottom, second, 168.
Yes. Yeah, there is differences.
Your eye would tell you, okay, I can kind of figure out what those first couple of wiggles are. I might even be able to describe them to a certain circuit component. I even see what frequency they are.
Yes. My assumption is
it would be immoral to put that in the simulation.
Well, that's true. My assumption is there's some inductance there that we're not accounting for example.
Probably even know what the inductance is.
That's probably correct, but the bottom line is that I didn't want to overcomplicate the model. This is the bare essentials, and I think the agreement is good enough to show the basic physics that's taking place.
I guess it just seems that you have two curves. You have your microwave pulse as a function of time, and you have your spin as a function of time.
Yes.
You may be able to self-consistently solve for both the spin and the microwave pulse.
That's an interesting idea. That's definitely something we should think about doing. Yeah, I see your point.
Without adding, thinking about it as adding lots of other parameters, because presumably you have some element that's your parameter that's not changing from one experiment to the next.
That's correct. No, I agree with you totally. I guess my point is we didn't want to do anything complicated. We wanted to keep it as simple as we could. So that's what you see. You're indeed correct. You could do that. And I think perhaps we should to better understand sort of the microwave engineering of these structures.
Yeah. Okay. So the switching time you would read off, let's say, from the 440 milliseconds,
The switching time is, it's right around, if you just start from zero, it's right around. But if you just go from here to there, it's less.
Less, yeah.
And the sort of the point, I think, here is that it actually comes from this, I think, it comes from this sort of fact that the phase of everything is really important in this case. You kind of have to wait for the counter-rotating field to get in the right position so that the two are together flipping it over. And that's why you sort of see nothing, and then all of a sudden it goes. And there is actually a lot of theory available, sort of time-optimal control theory, that describes this and includes the fact that you have to wait. And one of the things that they have discussed is that there, because of these effects, the optimal way to do microwave driving in this regime is not to use an oscillation for your driving. It's to use a square wave, the so-called bang-bang control. And that's, you know, but obviously the first thing you do is you look at the basic dynamics and the basic picture, and then you sort of do more advanced things from there. So that's what we're doing. Okay. So one of the things that you can point out in a very simple way, and you know, we're clearly running out of time, so let me just summarize. Why do we want to do this? Well, I alluded to it in the beginning. Diamond NV centers have great coherence properties, but you really need a lot of operations to do things. And so here we've already shown, if you just say 1 nanosecond, 1 millisecond, divide for single qubit operations, 10 to the 6 are possible. And that's kind of a nice effect.
Instead of doing that division, can you say what the fidelity of the single qubits this experiment? So you also have to worry about things.
Yeah, you're right. No, I agree totally. We have not measured the fidelity of these experiments. This is pretty hot off the presses, so no. Now, other people have measured the fidelity of sort of ESR in general, and they are getting 99% fidelity, but not in this regime. So that's an excellent point. I mean, there is clearly a lot of work that could be done. So, yeah. Okay. So that's basically my conclusion slide. So I told you a little bit about spin resonance in the excited state, which is a continuously evolving area, and then also our forays into strong driving, sort of violating the rotating wave approximation and thinking about different ways to do manipulation of the spin, going outside of the standard ESR techniques to try to go faster and do better. So, thank you very much for your.
Okay, thank you very much.
Questions? I'm kind of curious if in the strong driving device, whether you've taken a look at driving at the frequency associated with the -1.
So have we done strong driving from 0 to plus 1 in addition to 0 to minus?
I mean,
the plus 1 to minus 1 directly.
That's right, via the electric field.
That's an interesting idea. No, we have not done it. So one of the things is that these wouldn't be the right designed waveguides to do that, right? Because they're shorted. So you have an antinode in the B field and a node in the electric field.
If I'm always doing electric, that would be a problem, but this is a quadrupole term.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
Yeah, I think the instinct from a very similar looking waveguide in the double dot community is that electric field is a big problem as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You drive both magnetic and electric fields. So there's going to be a big electric field there.
I think you're probably right, yeah. I think that's correct.
I just wanted to clarify something. You mentioned twice the speed of 10 to the minus 5 data points, first starting each dot.
Yes, that's correct.
I assume that's 10 to the minus 5 different.
No, 10 to the 5, yeah.
Sorry, 10 to the 5 yeah. Different runs? Or is it within each run, you're able to sample somehow at 10 to 15?
Okay. Let me just tell you exactly how it works, and I think it'll be abundantly clear. We continuously run the duty cycle. It takes a few microseconds to finish, okay? But we only sort of send the counts, we window the counts that are available to the DAC so that you can't count any time except during the final state. Does that make sense? So then you just continuously read the counts on second time scales, sort of in lab time situations. And what that means is if you count for a second, and you have, say, a 10 microsecond duty cycle to your measurement, then you've already measured 10 to the, what, 5 times. Does that make sense?
So the narrowest time window that you actually measure that is like 10 to the minus 9?
We measure on a time window of a few hundred nanoseconds in each duty cycle, the total duration of which is, you know, microsecond duration. So you just keep doing that and doing that and doing that, and you're only counting the photons at the end, so that, you know, those are the counts that are sort of important. Does that? So, but you could think of each one of those.
The lateral x-axis space between two of those dots, how many nanoseconds?
50 picoseconds. So if you think about the experiment in terms of, yeah, so this is sampling, and that there's an important difference between sampling and continuous evolution. So you can think of this, each one of those couple microsecond things, as an individual experiment, because you collapse the wave function that one time. And you have to do statistics to get sort of, I mean, we're only measuring the population, the coefficients. We're not measuring the sort of phase. We're projecting it onto the x-axis,
or z-axis.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they. Well, it depends on what you. It's a square root of n kind of argument. Yeah. Oh, it's way smaller than the size of the dot. It's roughly the size of the dot.
Okay. Well, that's what it
is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's. It's correct. It's the size of the dot. Yeah. Because we just measure long enough that. I mean, obviously, the longer you measure, the more narrow it becomes.
That's the reason
they don't
have
errors. That's right.
But there are lines between the points, so the question is, if their structure on the scale is smaller than the distance between the points.
Well, actually,
I can see some things where there's like, it looks like a delta function.
No, so what you're actually saying is pretty smart. So if you look at standard. So let's say that we go out of the rotating. We're back into the rotating wave regime and just oversample the holy living daylights out of it. So, you know, what I showed you is these oscillations that are nice, right? But I was looking over 100 nanoseconds, so I was sampling. I had the same number of points, but this is 10 nanoseconds. That was 100, so that was, each point was a half a nanosecond, right? But actually, there is dynamics on that scale because there is a counter-rotating term. And so there's little wiggles. And in fact, if you just do the calculation, you know, Mathematica is a wonderful thing. You'll, if you just go fine-tune it into a small range, you'll see the little wiggles, and those little wiggles are from that counter-rotating field. However, we coarse grain. And so we're sort of that structure is being averaged over. But there, it's there.
So how big is that compared to the size of the
block? Well, how big is the structure?
Yeah.
Here, that structure is on the same order. So the Larmor precession frequency, which is what's setting that time scale, is a half a nanosecond. But this is 10 nanoseconds. Each dot is 50. So we have 10 dots per one precessional cycle. So here, we're fully sampling the dynamics from all the sort of physics that we expect to be going on.
Where are the little oscillations?
Well, these are it. Because what's going on is that everything now is on the same time scale. The Larmor precession rate and the driving fields are all causing rotations on the same time scale. So it's not going to look like a modulation of the sinusoidal Rabi oscillations like is what it is in the regular regime. It's going to look like something totally different because now you're adding all these terms and they're all having roughly the same amplitude. And so it's going to phase and everything is going to be important.
So is it really fair to call it a two-level system?
Yeah, it's still just two levels. I mean, the other level is up here. There's no population in it.
Right, okay, it's just a driving.
Yeah, it's just a driving. That's right. Yeah. And in fact, people have done some interesting experiments with, like, you know, really high intensity lasers, not two level systems, but sort of this regime where you get the phase of the carrier is important, related effect.
When you turn now the spin, can you do this, let's say, with one shot? Or, you know, what is the fidelity if I ask you now to turn the screen up and down in the initial state?
Okay.
These dots here are averaged over 10 to
10 to the 10 to the 5 times. Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
So if you would try now, let's say it's a dot which really, you know, turns the screen down there.
Like if I look at that dot?
Right. So I would expect that, you know, you would have a very...
I mean, the fidelity of arriving in that place, starting from here, just applying that pulse is excellent.
Okay, so one pulse and you are there.
You are there. And that's the point. And that's the point of doing this experiment. I mean, this is totally reproducible. I can go in there in this afternoon, put in that device, put in, you know, get the field, align it, and then we'll get that point to right there.
I guess you're pretty far from a single shot.
We're very far from a single shot measurement. I mean, a single shot measurement in this system would apply, I can measure one photon.
Right.
And I can measure one photon, but I don't know, I mean...
It's not just every photon.
Yeah. Well, and even that, if I measure just one photon, I mean, it's essentially I'm either measuring a photon or not measuring one.
Yeah.
So, yeah. At least with this scheme, I mean, that's why we don't have single shot. There's probably better ways to measure, but we're using the sort of traditional way to measure. But yeah, in the sense that I think you're asking, the fidelity is very, very good. Now, what we haven't done is tomography of these rotations. So the fidelity of the sort of projection on the z-axis is excellent. The, you know, what additional phases accumulate, if there's additional errors from that, I can't say because I don't have any. I haven't measured that, right? But yeah, that will take place. I mean, that's a further step.
Okay, good. Let's thank again.